From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Happy Halloween, everyone. So far, 2020 has been rife with tricks. So I have to say I'm ready for a sweet treat. In my little corner over here in the food world, Halloween marks the beginning of candy season. And I know that I remember sorting through my pillowcase or plastic pumpkin head after a long night of hoofing it all over the neighborhood. But this year, with trick-or-treating discouraged, it doesn't rule out having that special treat. Ben Mims is a cooking columnist for the LA Times, and he joins us with a couple of recipes for two of his favorite candy bars. They're my favorite candy bars as well. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Evan.
I can't believe we like the same candy bars.
I mean, you know, peanuts and chocolate or peanuts and caramel, just peanuts in general is always great.
Yeah, that's my thing too. So your premise that you start out with for convincing people to make candy is that if we had the patience for sourdough, we got this, right?
Prior to 2020, I never would have thought that people would make sourdough or let alone do any kind of project baking or project cooking on this large a scale. So I was like, you know what? I've been surprised this year. Everyone really got after sourdough, something that even I don't have the patience for. So if other people can do that, then I think candy making, you know, I think is even easier. So they should definitely be able to do that.
Okay, let's start with the easiest recipe of the two and walk us through the process.
So the easiest one are the payday bars. And I chose those because, you know, it really is as easy as cooking, you know, a caramelized milk fudge almost, and then just pouring it over chopped peanuts. And then you kind of roll it into a rope. And it's really easy because, you know, you don't have to deal with chocolate, nothing like that. And it's just one simple mixture that you cook in a saucepan. And the kind of brilliance of it is that it is almost like a dulce de leche in that you use sweetened condensed milk to, and you cook that down with a little bit of corn syrup, a little more sugar, and some butter. So it makes this really rich, you know, caramelly fudge. And what's so great about it in cooking sugar in general is that, you know, there's so many different degrees depending on what you cook the syrup to where you get different textures. And so this candy, you cook to a very low 238 degrees. It's kind of the first of the soft crack stages. And then you, once you pour it over peanuts, it kind of solidifies instantaneously. And once you let it sit for about 5 minutes, you can use your bare hands or gloves. It's not that hot. And you kind of roll it around more peanuts and eventually it just kind of sets into this fudgy peanut log that you just cut into pieces and voila, you have a candy much easier than I think most people even realize they could have.
So I know that people are going to hear the words corn syrup and they're going to go, why? Why do I need to add corn syrup? And there's actually a science reason for that.
That's right. Corn syrup is, you know, it's a sugar syrup that cannot crystallize. And so because it's, you know, regular sugar is sucrose, so it's fructose and glucose. Corn syrup is just glucose. So it produces that property where it cannot crystallize again. And that's great in making candy because the last thing you want is for when you melt your sugar for a sugar syrup to have it recrystallize, because if that happens in the pan, it kind of just becomes like a concrete block and you can't really do anything to it. You know, you could probably add a little more water to it and try to melt it again, but it just becomes a mess. And so candy makers add corn syrup to sugar and these kind of mixtures to keep it liquid so it doesn't recrystallize. But also corn syrup gives candy that kind of fudgy chew to certain candies that you come to expect. And without it, it's just not quite the same.
I have to say that one of the things that impressed me most of these recipes is that you include the process of setup and cleanup as part of the recipe, which I think is really smart because when you're handling sugar, hot sugar, if someone isn't telling you how to get ready at the beginning for what you're, how you're going to need to clean at the end, you're in for some hard times at the sink.
That's right. You know, it's one of those things where when I decided to do the story with my editor, I was like, you know, convincing people to make candy is going to be a hard stretch. The thing you have to do is manage people's expectations right out the gate. And so if you tell them that, hey, everything you're about to cook is going to be covered in sugar, but there's a way to make your life, you know, easy when it comes time to cleaning it and set yourself up for success, then it will make it a much easier process.
Do we really need a candy thermometer for these recipes? What if you only have a meat thermometer?
I mean, so if you have any kind of thermometer that you have, you know, in certain aspects, you could use it. You know, I have definitely made candy in the past where I stuck my instant read thermometer that's not very long into the syrup and held it with my bare hand. You know, I was playing with fire there. So I would not recommend that to the average home cook. And, you know, you could feasibly use a meat thermometer, but the great thing about candy thermometers is that, especially the stick style ones that I write about, is that they have very clear markings and they have like a mercury rising stick so you can see exactly what degree you're on, as opposed to meat thermometers or other kind of thermometers that are use a dial where the exact line that you're on is kind of hard to tell and you kind of have to guess. And with candy making, you really want to know the exact temperature that you're going for. You know, when I was in culinary school, we had a lesson in cooking sugar where you would cook sugar and then plunge your hand into a bowl of ice cold water for a few seconds and then shake the water off and reach your bare hand into the cooking sugar syrup to grab a piece of sugar and then kind of wad it up. And, you know, because your hand was cold, it instantly cooled the sugar and you could kind of squeeze the sugar ball and see if it was soft crack, hard crack, all those kind of things. Again, that's an extreme thing that I would never recommend for a home cook. So unless you have, you know, the wherewithal to do that, which I never would recommend, I think getting a candy thermometer will really make your life easier and ensure success in the long run.
So the next recipe involves making something which I think every human should make if possible because of its magic and deliciousness, and that is honeycomb.
Yes. Yeah, so the next recipe, I wanted to make a recipe that was a slightly more difficult than the payday bars, you know, where you're just simply pouring fudge over peanuts. And I had made these kind of this peanut butter candy before. And I was like, you know, this tastes just like a Butterfinger. This must be what they do to make them. So I basically made that candy again and found out that when you take a honeycomb and you mix it with smooth peanut butter, it can be, you know, the Jif kind, or it can be the all natural kind. It kind of creates these candy striations in the fat of the peanut butter. And it, you know, it makes that lovely kind of flaked shale, crispy texture that you know from a Butterfinger, which is one of my favorite things in the world. And so I just wanted to kind of make a homemade version of that, you know, add a little extra salt to kind of balance all the sugar, and then show people how to, you know, coat things in chocolate, which I think is another skill that I don't personally, you know, love tempering chocolate, but I wanted to kind of give people the next easiest way to cover candy in chocolate, because it is something that if you are going to make candy or truffles, you're eventually going to want to know at least one way of doing it.
Okay, so let's talk about tempering chocolate. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to add a caveat here that maybe you can address after you go through your easy way.
Okay.
That I don't have a microwave. So
you can still temper chocolate. You know, tempering chocolate, it is something that I think if you're a chocolatier or if you're someone who went to school to learn how to make chocolates and sugar work, obviously, it's kind of a bedrock skill. You need to know how to do it. But for your average home cook, you're likely never going to need to know how to do it. Even if you want to cover, let's say, a cookie or some kind of candy and chocolate, a lot of people do the old school kind of home cook method of melting chocolate chips with some shortening or something like that to kind of make this kind of shiny, firm coating on your cookies. You could also use coconut oil. I know that's used a lot as well. But what tempering chocolate really does, and the process, is you melt chocolate and then you kind of cool it down to another temperature, which is slightly above room temperature. And then you kind of rewarm it a few degrees again. And what that does is it kind of aligns a specific fat in the cocoa butter that when it cools and sets, creates that kind of snappy, shiny texture and feel that we know and love from candy bars, like, you know, a Hershey bar or any kind of thing like that. So that is the attributes that you're wanting to bring out whenever you coat something in chocolate. So to do that, it just involves a lot of heating and a lot of using thermometers to make sure you get it exactly right. And then even when you do get it exactly right, you have a small window of time to cover a lot of candy before you then have to start the process over again. And that was kind of the part for me that always made it the most difficult, because when you're covering candy, you have dozens of pieces to cover. So you're rarely going to be able to cover everything in chocolate before you have to, you know, start the whole process over again. And so I kind of researched other methods that people had used. And there was one that, you know, a lot of home cooks have used for years, which is called the seeding method. And that is where you melt most of your chocolate either in a microwave, or the other way to do it is over a double boiler, and you melt your chocolate till it's completely melted. And then you take that chocolate off the heat and you add, you know, chopped unheated chocolate to it, and you just kind of stir until everything is melted. And that will get you as close as you possibly can to properly tempered chocolate. You know, it won't be as shiny as if you did it the correct way, but it will set firmly. It will give you a little bit of a snap, and it will be slightly duller. But I think, you know, for making your own candy and tempering your own chocolate, I think that's, you know, something that most people can live with, because it still gets you where you want to go.
Well, thank you so much, Ben. I really have to say I'm definitely making those payday bars.
That's awesome to hear. Thank you so much, Evan.
Happy Halloween.
You too.
That's Ben Mims, cooking columnist for the LA Times, with two at-home versions of his favorite candy bars. Coming up, hot cheese and good drinks, my two favorite book titles of 2020. I've got both authors here with me next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Last week, I put the question out over social media, what will you be eating on election night? I have to say, I laughed out loud at some of the answers, like when someone responded, my feelings. But in all the varied responses, I noticed a theme: comfort, warm soups, popovers with butter, wine, of course, and the old standby mac and cheese. Nachos, a croque-monsieur, stuffed shells, and a quesadilla. What is made better by cheese, Alex? If cheese was a Jeopardy category, the melty recipes in Polina Chesnikova's new book would provide all the answers. And who can resist a book with the title Hot Cheese? Her dishes are comforting, accessible, and the perfect cozy we're all looking forward to this Tuesday, and later, over and over, through fall and winter. Hi, Polina.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I am enticed by this book, and I know that because I'm a very suggestible eater, when we finish this interview, I'm going to have to go make something that's melty.
Yeah, you definitely have to. We all need some comfort food in our lives right now.
For sure. So let's talk about khachapuri, which is really having a moment these days. Mm-hmm. You're of Russian-Georgian descent. Did you grow up eating the boat-like molten comfort food version?
You know, it's interesting because I think when people think of khachapuri, their minds immediately go to that image, right, of the cheese boat. But I actually didn't have that version until I was probably 15 or 16. Many people don't know that there are actually many versions of khachapuri. Every region has its own take on it. So that Ajaruli khachapuri, the cheese boat, comes from the region of Ajaria. But there's this other version called Imaruli khachapuri. It comes from the region of Imeretia. And it's almost, I like to describe it as a flattened cheese-filled calzone. And that you would find is probably the most popular version of khachapuri across Georgia. It's ubiquitous. You have it for, you know, they serve it for breakfast, lunch, dinner, eat leftovers as a snack. And that for sure is the version that I grew up with the most, along with another version that uses puff pastry. It's baked in a sheet pan and you cut it into squares and you've got that flaky golden pastry that gives way to melty cheese. So those are actually the versions I grew up and didn't really discover, you know, the Ajorulli version until I was older.
And in fact, that's the boat version is what you feature in the book.
Right.
What type of dough is it and what kind of cheese are you using?
Yeah, so the dough is a yeasted dough. It's super simple. It's flour, water, a bit of sugar, salt, a bit of yeast, and a little bit of oil to kind of make it a bit more tender. And for the filling, traditionally it's made with a combination of Georgian sulguni, which is a cow's milk cheese, and emmerulli cheese, which is kind of almost more curd-like. Of course, we don't have those cheeses here in the States. And so my family likes to do a blend of mozzarella because it kind of has that, you know, elasticy texture that the sulguni has, and mix it with feta because sulguni is also briny. And so you have the mozzarella, the feta, and then you add a bit of ricotta to kind of mimic that fresh curd-like emmerulli cheese.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's so good. What most people don't know, and one of my favorite things about the Ajorulli Hachapuri is, you know, it comes from the region of Jharia, and those people historically were boat builders. And at some point, they decided to turn their Hachapuri into, you know, a boat. And so the shape, of course, symbolizes the boat. The filling symbolizes the sea, and the egg that they add at the end actually symbolizes the sun. So it's a really sweet image, I think.
I love that. And I've never heard that before. So the words sweater weather are rare, actually, in Southern California, but we're finally seeing it. And I know all over the country people are. So I want to get to some stick to your ribs dishes that are perfect for eating when we're just in our sweats and socks in front of the TV. That shepherd's pie tater tot hot dish.
Oh, yeah.
Using tater tots instead of like a puff pastry or mashed potatoes just seems a bit ingenious.
Yeah, I mean, you know, with all of the recipes, I took a lot of recipes that I thought were, you know, very classic, that would be very familiar to folks. But I also wanted to give, you know, put my own twist on all of it. And so I always kind of challenge myself, like, okay, how do I make this more interesting? And, you know, tater tots is just another form of potatoes. And you've got that, you know, nice golden crunchy exterior that gives way to the, you know, soft, tender inside. And so I thought that was a really nice foil to the creamy shepherd's pie filling. And it's actually one of the dishes that I've seen a lot of people making from the book.
Oh, I'm sure. You actually drench the top with this cheddar cheese gravy almost. Could you describe that? I think a lot of people have trouble with melting cheese seizing up or getting grainy. How did you approach that in this book?
Right. So that is, you know, one of the things that people get wrong, right? When they start to cook with hot cheese. And, you know, the two things that I always tell folk is you have to be mindful of time and temperature, because cheese is essentially this matrix of protein and fat. And if you apply too much heat at too high of a temperature for too long, those proteins start to clump together and disconnect from the fat. And so what you get is this grittiness, right? These like clumps of cheese with pools of fat. And no one really wants that when they're trying to make something that's really comforting. And so with the tater tots, when you look at the recipe, you don't really add the cheese until the very end just to melt it, you know? And you'll see that a lot in a lot of my recipes, even the macaroni and cheese. You make what is essentially a Mornay sauce. So it's a bechamel, it's a white sauce that you add cheese to it. You mix your al dente pasta and you top it with buttery Ritz crackers and you throw it in the oven. And you only need to bake it for 15 minutes just to warm it through and get all nice and gooey and you know, melt together. And the edges start to bubble, but that's it. And if you start to cook it, and if you continue to cook it even longer, it'll just start to turn gritty and oily. So, yeah, time and temperature. And you'll see that throughout the book, that I'm very mindful of that.
It's really a wonderful book, and I think it's just the giant hug that we need right now.
Thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Have a wonderful holiday season.
Thanks. You too, Evan.
That's Polina Chesnokova. We've been talking about all things gooey, oozy, and melty. Her book is Hot Cheese. If there was ever an excuse to reach for the bottle, it's 2020. Americans are drinking more than ever, which, unless you're a liquor company, is not always a good thing. But before COVID-19 was part of our daily lexicon, many started their year with a dry January, and even more continue to cut out or cut back on alcohol for whatever the reason. Julia Bainbridge spent a fair amount of time in her car back in 2018, traversing the country in search of what she calls good drinks, the name of her new book. Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me here.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. It's a gorgeous little book. Let's start with the title. I mean, there have been so many different iterations of trying to name cocktails or drinks without alcohol, virgin cocktails, mocktails, zero proof.
Yep.
What other monikers did you run across, and how did you settle on good drinks?
So there are so many. The great Kimber English, I think, has cataloged them all somewhere. There are some 60, some odd names being given to these drinks. I saw teetotalers, I saw temperance drinks, zero proof cocktails, neutral cocktails, which I don't know really what that is, zero ABV drinks, alcohol-free cocktails, virgin cocktails. I mean, the list goes on. The menu nomenclature is its own thicket of awkwardness, as my friend Jordana puts it. But my approach has been to sort of sidestep this debate. This is a book, not a bar. I don't think it would be fair to call them good drinks if I were in a bar or on a menu. But think about when people make plans with each other to get a drink. It's assumed that that drink means an alcoholic one, right? And that you're meeting in a bar. And I guess my intent is to subvert that a little bit by just calling them drinks. Of course, the subtitle then, the Dr. Susie and Long subtitle, has to be clear about what we're talking about here, which is alcohol-free cocktails. But yeah, they're just drinks. They're good drinks.
And so now this word alcohol-free, I have to get into that too.
Yes.
Because a lot of what we're drinking, even including things like bitters, that we think of as not having any alcohol at all, in fact, does have a little bit.
Right. So, you know, even orange juice has trace amounts of alcohol in it. So it's a bit of a misnomer, like alcohol-free, true. But I guess I consider that to be what the law considers it to be, meaning 0.5 ABV and under is alcohol-free.
So interesting.
Yeah. But I do think that that's the best terminology. I think I was with Lorelei Bendrovsky, who's the owner of Listen Bar, which is an alcohol-free bar, had some really smart things to say about this whole nomenclature thing at a Tales of the Cocktail panel recently. And she said that with the word non-alcoholic, you're kind of telling someone no out of the gate, right? And you're positioning alcohol as the thing to say yes to. And that wasn't jiving with what she saw happening, which was people were moving away from the narrative of restriction, like I can't drink because I'm pregnant or driving or because of my religion, to a narrative of preference, a choice not to drink tonight. So she went for alcohol-free cocktails. It's kind of more positive, right? In that it doesn't have that restrictive connotation. And we're already familiar with that structure of, you know, gluten-free, sugar-free, et cetera.
Instead of organizing by style or ingredient, you opted to structure the recipes by occasion. Why did you go this route?
Going by ingredient didn't make too much sense to me because I wanted to show a wide range of flavors. I mean, this really is a compendium, you know? And then if I think of going by base, you know, ingredient in terms of what's the base of each drink, milk base, tea base, that just didn't seem very sexy to me. So I think, you know, my mood and what I'm craving are really driven by time of day and occasion. And I think the reasons you reach for a non-alcoholic drink are just as diverse as the reasons you reach for an alcoholic drink and should be given the same attention. And so this is kind of meant to guide the reader as to how to use them. So sometimes you drink to relax, sometimes to connect, sometimes to let loose or toast the end of the day. These drinks all satisfy those diverse needs.
So let's open up the pantry. Tell us about the drinks using everyday ingredients like tahini, for example.
After doing this research, I discovered that there isn't much you probably couldn't use in a drink. I saw some really innovative uses of everyday pantry ingredients. With tahini, you know, that's it's really nutty and creamy. And in this particular drink called the Lorca, it's combined with kefir, or it's, you know, lightly fermented milk, and a bit of honey syrup, which kind of rounds out both the tartness and the nuttiness. And I just think it's like a sophisticated milkshake, you know, with a little crushed ice that helps thin it out a little bit so it's not too dense. It's a really nutty, creamy treat.
And what about miso?
So this is Sean Umstead in North Carolina is the author of this recipe, which is apple and miso. And for him, cocktails and food are really no different. Like the drink is composed like a dish. And so in this case, the savory miso balances out the sweetness of the apple juice. And it becomes something you really must sip slowly. And I think that's often the criticism that non-alcoholic beverages have gotten historically is that, like, usually it's a syrup and soda or it's something in a Collins glass that's like a guzzler, you know, and not the kind of thing around which you can socialize and sort of sip slowly and spend some time with your friends. And so this drink is definitely that kind of drink.
So pickle brine is something that many of us have brought into our classic cocktails. You have one called Nectar of the Gods.
Yes, this was somebody else noted how often various brines show up in this book, and I think that has more to do with reflecting the author's taste than any trend going on. I just tend towards salty, savory things. And, you know, I think brine and soda alone is a great, like, saltier, funkier alternative to a syrup and soda, you know, a sweetened soda, but equally simple. And I think with this recipe, Nectar of the Gods, Minetta Gould, who's the author, really just kicked that up a notch by adding a little citrus juice to the mix. And she used jarred sweetie drops, which are pickled Peruvian peppers. But like pepadew, sweet cherry peppers, even bread and butter pickles could work too. But in that case, I might, you know, reduce or omit the simple syrup if you go for bread and butters, which are sweeter. But yeah, I mean, I think of it as kind of like a water seasoning to use various brines.
I love that. Water, I mean, that is like a genius phrase.
Yeah, it's like, if you're trying to hydrate, as we all should be in general, and especially right now, and you're on your third big glass of water, just kind of season it a little. Maybe you can do that with bitters. Maybe you do that with something sweet one round. But I also really love a little salty seasoning.
Thank you so much, Julia.
Thanks so much for being interested. More soon.
That's Julia Bainbridge. We've been discussing alcohol-free recipes to get us through 2020. Her book is Good Drinks, and her marvelous podcast is The Lonely Hour, available on Stitcher. Before the break, I want to say a heartfelt thank you to all the listeners who supported us during this membership drive. We are so grateful for your support, and we so appreciate you. I mean it when I say that your ears are what gives meaning to what we do here at Good Food. Once again, I'm terribly sorry if I mispronounce your name. Big, big thanks to all my Californians. Tyson Iravani, Sean Lacey, Sasha Taylor, Gretchen Nielsen, Summer Moore, Ellen Brown, Tanya Becerra, Ann Weber, Tita Bolger, Nancy Covey, Wendy Yao, Devin Kenyon, Eric Helm, Nancy Collins, Annie Wells, John Dodson, Pamela Gover, Eric Quisen, Kimberly Andres, Antonio Esparza, Tori Hettinger. And to my out-of-towners, I see you. Josh Nierberg in Colorado, Kathleen Riley in South Carolina, Mary Lowry of Portland, Maine, Ellie Anders of Philly, Marjorie Miller in Scarsdale, Steve Wellner in D.C., Eliza Armstrong in New York, from Massachusetts, both Tanya Lubich-Nawaka and Mary Heisner, Dora Lona Rose in Pennsylvania, Sarah Brokaw in Minneapolis, and Emily Kripe in Chicago. There were also so many who podcast from international locations, and we could really see that the Good Food community is a global village. You all mean so much to me. If you're listening, thank you, thank you, thank you. And in 1 minute, I'll be back with a food writer who was challenged to go vegan without sacrificing flavor. Stay with us. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Prior to accepting The Guardian's position as their vegan columnist, Mira Soto's background was in Indian cooking. Also, she was a new mom and, well, not vegan. The challenge was an opportunity to explore new cuisines and develop recipes that were healthy but didn't hijack flavor. Compiling her Guardian column with new dishes, her latest cookbook is East, and it features both vegan and vegetarian meals. Hi, Mira.
Hello. Hello, Evan.
It's lovely to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with tofu. You say that you were a tofu denier at one point. What dish was the game changer for you?
Oh, well, that was chili tofu, because I didn't really understand all the breadth and the depth of tofu when I first ate it. But the game changer for me was a dish called chili tofu, which I ate with my dad in Leicester. It was a take on chili paneer. It's a deep fried tofu coated in corn flour and then fried until the edges become like super crispy and a bit chewy, whilst the middle remains sort of pillow soft. I mean, the texture is just gorgeous. And because it's fried and coated in a little bit of flour, it allows the surface of the tofu to just absorb whatever sauce you want to throw at it. And the chili sauce is it's sort of like an Indo-Chinese dish, a combination of it. It's a very sort of popular dish in India. And so just imagine sort of a like super spicy, sweet, salty, delicious, tomato-y dish flavored with soy sauce. And that's the one that changed my mind.
So famously, we Californians love our avocados. And you give your avocado cachumber a Dickensian dub as, quote, a tale of two salads, unquote. Explain that and also share what a cachumber is.
Cachumber is, it means cut into little pieces in Hindi. It really is India's major salad. Most Indian salads are called kachumbar. India doesn't major on salads because most food is cooked in India because potential bugs and the water hygiene is still not up to the standard that it to be able to eat fresh food all over India. When I meant a tale of two salads, it has two parts to it, and the avocado is blended with yogurt to become something, you know, that gorgeous buttery quality that avocado has. I've just sort of created a sort of sauce on which to put like a sort of quite sharp, tart, crunchy, fresh salad. It's not typically what you would find in India at all. It's sort of a very bastardized version of a kachumbar. But that's what I love about thinking about the possibility of India in the future is what salads could look like when the water quality is good and you can just eat fresh, crunchy food. What could Indian salads look like? And that's, as a food writer and as an Indian food writer, that's what I love doing, is thinking about the future of Indian salad. And so that is just one salad in a long line of possible salads that might exist in the future in India.
So this year, this lovely year of 2020, And a lot of us have been cooped up or sequestered. And snacking, you know, seems to become very acceptable. And you consider yourself a snack ambassador. Could you tell us how you incorporate overnight soy eggs into larger meals?
The soy eggs are really what you would find on like ramen dishes. I love them. I keep a jar of them in my fridge most weeks just because they're just the perfect snack. I soft boil them for about sort of 7 to 8 minutes and then give them a bath in soy and mirin, just a sweet mirin and vinegar for, well, they can sort of stay in that bath overnight. And then they are automatically just have a wonderful flavor and are soft boiled. So you can use them in many ways. I like to pop them whole. And so that's how I like to eat them. But I love them with greens. And so at this time of year in the UK, Cavalla Nera or black kale is on our farmer's market stalls. So I like to just pan fry some of that with some garlic and eat it with the soy eggs. They're also lovely on toast, actually. Just sort of cut open on some hot toast. I don't think because I can eat them just like that, there's not very many ways in which I wouldn't eat a soy egg is probably the answer to your question. You know, not on cereal or anything like that, obviously, but on most other savory dishes that could potentially incorporate an egg.
So many of these foods are enhanced by the use of condiments, and I've been told by several friends that I'm a condiment zealot. So I would love if you would talk about the hot cashew sauce and the carrot achar.
If we talk about nuts, like nuts are a phenomenal resource for vegans because you get that. If you take dairy out of your diet and butter, if you take dairy out of your diet, you know, you're looking for that lovely creamy mouthfeel. And nuts can provide that. And if you look at all nuts, the cashews are the softest. I don't know if that's because they contain the most amount of oil, but they're the creamiest to me. I love them. And so when you soak them in hot water for a little bit and then blend them, they just turn into the most delicious cream. And so all I've done there is, you know, to add a little bit of chili into the hot cashew sauce and soak them for a little bit and blend them together with some garlic. And I mean, again, it's sort of one of those things, if you like mayonnaise or if you like sort of creamy sauces, it's something that you can douse over. It's not a substitute, it's just different. And in my eyes, it's potentially better. But so that's the hot cashew sauce. And the carrot achar is a South Indian pickle. I love South Indian flavors and in particular curry leaves. I don't know how familiar you are with curry leaves, but they don't taste of curry. They taste of citrus and smoke, which are two things that I love, both citrus and smoke. And so you snap, crackle and pop these curry leaves in some hot oil and they flavor the oil. And then I sort of throw in the carrots with a lot of these traditional pickling spices, coriander, cumin, black mustard seeds, and fenugreek seeds. And together that is it's like a combination of special spices that give food their sort of pickling flavor. And yeah, I think carrots are one of those things, they're sort of a side, you know, it's a vegetable that a lot of people have at the bottom of their vegetable drawer. They have a natural sweet flavor. And so when you sort of add heat and add vinegar in the form of lemon juice or vinegar, they can, you know, they sort of become that perfect pickling vegetable, by which I mean they can take salt and they can take heat and they can take spice and they're already sweet and you can sort of see, you know, they can create a wonderful pickle.
Well, it's a lovely book. I look forward to cooking from it some more. Thank you so much, Mira.
Evan, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
That was Mira Soda. Her book is East, 120 Vegan and Vegetarian Recipes from Bangalore to Beijing. It's so nice that we can finally talk about fall recipes. So let's head over to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what chefs are buying for cozy meals this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I'm in Santa Monica this week with Michelle Lainez, who has been shopping this market for years, first as part of the Border Grill team, then as a caterer and as the chef behind Vamonos, a food truck that is parked outside Alana's Coffee Roasters in Mar Vista. And Michelle, we're just a couple days away from Election Day now. I understand you have something special planned. What's on the docket?
I'm so excited. So first, I love beans. And so for everyone who votes between 7 a.m. and 2 p.m., they can come down to the Vamonos truck and Alana's Coffee Roasters and get a 12-ounce cup of coffee and a black bean and cheese burrito, a mini black bean and cheese burrito.
So you're telling me that you're giving out free burritos?
Oh, yeah, the best black bean and cheese burrito.
I think you're going to be very popular on Election Day. All right, so tell us about these beans.
These beans are magic. I'm obsessed with them. I get them from Milliken Farms. This is the bean that I have in my house. I've used it in restaurants for years. And Milliken Farms, I don't know, it's the soil or the way they're picking them, but the beans are just, they're smaller than the regular black bean, and they smell different. Like when you cook them, black bean definitely have a strong smell. These smell a little bit more savory and sweet in a way when you cook them. They don't fill your house with that bean smell. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
But they're just really delicious. And, you know, I braise them low and slow. You don't have to cook them forever, which is great because they're fresher. They don't store them for like years at a time. I mean, they're probably only like 3 to 4 months old.
Right.
And so they cook faster, they hold their nutrients, and they just taste so good. I can't get over it.
So do you use any aromatics when you're cooking them?
A little bit. I mean, they get bell peppers, chipotles, onions, garlic, and a bay leaf, you know, for color. But that's it.
Yeah. So you're doing bean and cheese burritos. Do the beans stay whole inside the burritos, or do you mash them up?
It's half-half.
Whoa.
So I pull out some of the chipotles because, you know, I don't need anyone to burn their mouths, but with the spice. But I do, it's a half mash. So I just take half of them, put them in the blender, and then pour them back inside. So you get whole bean and mash bean. Ooh. It's important, texture.
Absolutely. It's all about the texture. And what kind of cheese are you using?
American cheese. I know. It's just one of those things.
Yeah,
like, it's so good, and it's melty,
yeah,
and it's kind of like a queso.
Oh, my God. It sounds awesome, and I know that you're using some very special tortillas, too.
Oh, yeah. Tehachapi Grain Project, Sonora tortillas. They're freaking amazing. I was so pumped when she started making them. I was like, yes, I need those in my life. That's what I use on the truck. That's what I use at home. That's what we're going to use for Election Day. They're perfect 10-inch tortillas. I love them.
I think these burritos will be very greatly appreciated on Election Day. So thank you so much, Michelle.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
That was Michelle Lainez. This Tuesday from 7 to 2 p.m., bring your I Voted sticker to Vamonos at Alana's Coffee in Mar Vista for a free burrito made by Michelle. It's while supplies last, so be sure to get out early and vote, and then celebrate with a burrito. Lori Heal of Two Peas in a Pod up in San Luis Obispo County is one of the farmers who brings a bunch of beans to the market every single week. Lori, let's start with the life cycle of the bean. You always have some fresh beans on the table right now. I see some dragon tongue beans. When did these come to market?
Oh, we've been bringing in the fresh beans for probably about almost 3 months now. And we're getting to the end of the season, and we're letting a lot of the fresh beans turn into dry beans. And the dry beans is what holds us over for the winter.
All right. And what's the process of drying the beans? Do you just let them dry in the pod?
Oh, my gosh. It's it is a process, but it's beautiful. So what we do is we'll pick the fresh, and there's always times that we cannot keep up with all the fresh because we plant religiously every, like, 2.5 weeks. The kids are planting beans so that we don't have gaps in our plantings. So as we go with the plantings, the beans will dry up. So we leave them in the field to dry up. Later on in the season, like about 3 or 4 weeks later, we come back and we pull the roots out of the ground and we put them in piles to dry. After that is done, we collect them all and we lay them on tarps. And we go out there and we beat them with these sticks. It's crazy. Or we'll run over them with our tractors or our vehicles because the pods are so hard and crisp. Then we gather them, and my husband made these like screens, and we sift through them. After that, we also wait for a kind of windy day, and we hold these buckets up, and we let the wind blow all these little debris, and the beans will follow.
Wow.
And it's literally hours and hours of sometimes kind of just sitting on the kitchen counter or laying in the field, picking out the little sticks and the little rocks and sorting through them, because some of our beans are very tiny.
So are the dry beans that you're bringing to market right now beans that you've just gone through this process with?
Absolutely, yes. Yes.
I noticed one type of bean that I've never seen dried before on the table, the dragon tongue bean, which you have here fresh in the pod. It's such a beautiful bean. Got like speckles of purple. You can eat the pod whole when they're fresh, but then you also have some dry dragon tongue beans. What's the story there?
Oh, that was so fun. So we had a chef last year come up to us and say, Lori, do an experiment. Let some of these fresh dragon beans dry and let's see what happens. So we did, and it was a wow factor. They're a little brown bean, and once you soak them and cook them, they blow up like this. The only way I could describe it is like, you know, like pork and beans in a can, a brown bean that melts in your mouth and is so creamy.
Wow.
They're delicious. Very delicious.
I also noticed you have two types of black beans. Michelle, who we just talked to earlier, she gets the cocoa beans. For her black bean burritos, but you have both cocoa beans and black turtle beans. What's the difference between the two?
They're both delicious, but the cocoa bean is a much creamier bean, a thinner skin bean. It's probably the most flavorful bean of a black bean.
Do you have a favorite bean?
I have a favorite. Actually, I have a couple of favorites, but my old standby, and I keep going back, is I love our Christmas limas. And I don't doctor them up. They're super, super creamy. They melt in your mouth. I know as a kid, a lot of people said, ooh, lima beans. I was probably one of them. But as an adult, or just cooking them right, they literally melt in your mouth. And they're a beautiful, creamy bean.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Lori.
Thank you. I feel honored that you would think of us.
That was Lori Heal of Two Peas in a Pod. You can find her and those great beans at the Wednesday Santa Monica, Sunday Hollywood, and Saturday Santa Barbara Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, the amazing story of a father and son and what we're willing to give up for family. The story of Anna Jack Tye when Good Food returns. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. What would you give up for your family? In the case of Justin Pichuk-Rungsi, the answer was his career. Justin grew up playing hide-and-seek among the tables of his family's 39-year-old restaurant, Anna Jack Tye in Sherman Oaks. He's now behind the wok, making innovative changes, all while carrying on his family legacy. He joins us with this story for this week's In the Weeds.
My name is Justin Pichuk-Rungsi. I'm the chef owner at Anna Jack Tye Restaurant here in Sherman Oaks. Anna Jack is a restaurant that was started by my father. We opened in 1981. My father started then, and we've been in the same location in Sherman Oaks as a neighborhood spot for 39 years. And we have a lot of regulars. I would say that most of our customers are regulars, folks that have been in Sherman Oaks and in the Valley for a while. And I grew up here. I grew up in the back. I grew up in the kitchen. I grew up in the front of the house, watching my father work behind the wok. I mean, seeing him super charming behind the tables, seeing my parents work together. I mean, my parents would always have me front of house, you know. They'd push me out to the tables. They'd say, go, go, go. Go to table two and introduce yourself. I'm like, you're not gonna come with me? And they're like, no. Just tell them you're Rick's son. Go say hi. And it's that kind of spot. My dad's originally Cantonese from by way of Bangkok. He was born in Bangkok and was always a hustler when he was a little kid, worked in clubs and bars and hostess bars and hotels when he was 13. He's just been like in the hospitality industry his whole life. And when he came here in his 20s, he was working as a tempura cook, a fry cook at a Japanese restaurant, pretty popular Japanese restaurant, simultaneously at Jack in the Box. And he eventually moved his way up in the Japanese restaurant called Miyako until he became the head sushi chef. And back then, there wasn't a lot of like non-Japanese sushi chefs, but he's very good at cutting fish. And all of his staff meals that he would make would be Thai, obviously. After 12 years of working in at Miyako and doing Japanese food, he said to his boss, "I think I'm gonna open up my own spot." And there he was with just by himself, opened up this tiny little spot here. We expanded just to the tenant next door shortly thereafter. But he's 71 years old now. He had a stroke about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And so he doesn't cook anymore, but I'm very fortunate that he was able to teach me how to cook when he was still behind the wok, still on the line. I mean, he was on the line, you know, his whole life. It was his dream to open the restaurant, and there it is. Before I worked at Anna Jack, and before this became my full-time thing, I was working as a concept artist and an art director at the Walt Disney Company in Imagineering and in Interactive. I didn't know how I was going to make it over to making the restaurant a full-time thing. You know, when you're working a big, you know, corporate job, you have these dreams and you never know how those things are going to happen. After my father's stroke, my mother said, "Well, I mean, I know you don't want to think of it this way, but the universe is giving you an opening to finally do what you've always wanted to do." Being a restaurateur now feels, as it always has felt, a very multidisciplinary job. And it is very stressful because things are changing so fast. I mean, we've seen so many changes in the last 6 months, and you can see that as like one big change because of COVID. But every week it feels a little bit different. When we finally like moved into the phase where I said, you know what, I want to be creative now. I don't want to feel confined anymore. I'm just going to do whatever I want to do, because if it works, then cool. If it doesn't work, nothing was working anyways. So why not just try it? And I was making tacos for staff meal. So my cooks are from Oaxaca and Mexico City. And it was just, I was like, just playing around. I was like trying to impress them with, you know, my taco making abilities, and, you know, got these tortillas from Princesita. And I was like, oh yeah, like very excited about, you know, doing this to impress the guys, the team. And they're like, oh yeah, this is pretty good. And I was like, you know what, maybe I'll just be a taquero for a day. Let's just try it out. So then that's how Thai Taco Tuesday started, was just trying to impress my cooks. And it just turned into a really fun way to like transform the night that was so slow, right? Tuesday nights in restaurants, so slow, into something that, you know, has energy. I thought about it recently, like, how long do I want to keep doing it this way? You know, this way is actually kind of hard. You know, how can I grow the restaurant in a responsible way? Like, I think my responsibility is to be the steward of Anna Jack. And it's an honor and a pleasure for me to like to take care of it, to take care of the people, to take care of the rickety, rusted building with, you know, the doors that kind of work and the burners that only work like this when you turn the knob like this. And, you know, my job has been to maintain it. And I think that in the future, my job will hopefully be to grow it and to see it continue on, hopefully at least another 40 years. I mean, I know that's insane, but I mean, I look up to all these winemakers and they're like multi-generational. I'm like, wow, isn't that incredible? I just want to continue having fun doing this because I love doing it. And let's see, if you come tonight to Anajack, you have two courses of options. One, you can make a reservation and we have a single private table in our alley. That menu is the normal dine-in menu, or you can actually do, I guess, what we're calling the Thai omakase. So that's like a course out, sort of 10, 12 courses where I'll cook for you stuff that's off the menu, a lot of dry-aged seafood specialties, chili dips, things that I want to serve that we can't do in the form of takeout. If you can't do one of those, then actually I think the best option is do takeout. Of course, order fried chicken. Of course, get the meatballs, the lap tot. There's northern style meatballs are delicious. And grill hold fish is probably one that I'm the most proud of. And it's typically dry aged for 1 week. And it's my father's Nam Chim seafood sauce. So there's a little bit of me and a little bit of his vision in it.
That was Justin Peachet-Rungsi, second-generation chef and owner of Anajack Thai in Sherman Oaks. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Paul Smith, Gary Masiha, and Kenny Ng. Find some inner peace this week with some good drinks and definitely some hot cheese. I'll see you on the other side with a new episode of Good Food.